From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now.
And I am from here, and here I am. And I am I, and here I am. And I am I.
Acclaimed Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish has died. He was 67 years old. We'll hear more of his words and speak to two poets who have translated his work, one a doctor in Houston at the hospital where he died. Then we'll speak with Eloise Cobell.
This is the worst accounting nightmare that anybody had ever seen. In the meantime, in our communities, in our Indian communities, people are living in dire poverty. People that have oil wells pumping in their backyards are not receiving their money.
Eloise Cobell is the lead plaintiff on behalf of 500,000 Native Americans in the largest class action lawsuit against the U.S. government. The suit was seeking $47 billion to account for royalties due on seized Native lands. A judgment came down last week. It's just a fraction of the amount that they have been seeking. But first, as the fighting between Georgia and Russia escalates, we'll speak to retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A war between Russia and the U.S.-backed nation of Georgia over the breakaway regions of South Ossetia appears to be widening after 4 days of intense fighting. Russia estimates more than 2,000 people have been killed in South Ossetia, and the Red Cross says at least 40,000 have been forced to flee their homes. So far, the fighting centers on the autonomous region of South Ossetia, a section of Georgia that declared its autonomy in 1989. In March, South Ossetia asked the world to recognize its independence from Georgia following the West's support for Kosovo's secession from Serbia. On Friday, Georgian forces attacked South Ossetia's capital to retake the breakaway region. 10 Russian peacekeepers were killed when they were shelled by Georgian forces. In response, Russia launched an air, land, and sea assault on Georgia. Georgia's ambassador to the United Nations, Irakli Alisenia, accused Russia of using indiscriminate force.
For the last 12 hours, inhuman and indiscriminate aerial bombardments of the Georgian territory continued. The scale of devastating destructions and loss of innocent lives has yet to be assessed. Russian ground troops armed invasion transformed already in a full-scale occupations of parts of Georgian territory. The process of extermination of Georgian population.
The Russian ambassador to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, blamed the outbreak of violence on Georgia.
What is taking place now is not unexpected. The Russian Federation, as you recall, on many occasions drew attention to the dangerous situation which is now evolving around South Ossetia. The Russian Federation on many occasions drew attention to the fact that Georgia was increasing at an increasing rate its offensive weapons. Georgia is the record holder of increasing its military budget, which over the years has grown 30 times, and now we understand the purpose of all of this.
Georgia is a close ally of the United States, which has been pushing for Georgia to join NATO. Over the weekend, the U.S. military began airlifting 2,000 Georgian troops stationed in Iraq back home. Last month, 1,200 U.S. troops took part in military exercises in Georgia. Both the U.S. and Israel have helped arm Georgia's military. Georgia also plays a pivotal role in the supply of oil from the Caspian region to the west, as the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceylan oil pipeline runs through much of the country. We'll have more on the war in Georgia after headlines. Iraq's foreign minister, Hoshyar Zebari, said Sunday the United States must provide a very clear timeline to withdraw its troops from Iraq as part of an agreement allowing them to stay beyond this year.
There has to be a very clear timeline.
With dates in it.
Timeline. Okay.
The Iraqi foreign minister's statement was the strongest public assertion yet that Iraq is demanding a plan for U.S. troops to withdraw. A new article in The Atlantic magazine has revealed Hillary Rodham Clinton's top strategist had urged her to target what he described as Barack Obama's lack of American roots because he was raised in Indonesia. In a memo dated March 30th, the strategist, Mark Penn, advised Clinton to criticize Obama for having a limited connection to, quote, basic American values and culture. Penn wrote, "I cannot imagine America electing a president during a time of war who's not at his center fundamentally American in his thinking and in his values." Bolivia, President Evo Morales has claimed an easy victory and a recall victory. The recall pitted Morales against governors who have pushed for autonomy for their resource-rich provinces. Unofficial exit polls said Morales secured more than 60% of the vote, more than 54% he won when elected in December 2005. Morales plans now to proceed with his agenda of nationalizing Bolivia's energy resources and giving more power to the poor.
Lo que hoy día ha expresado el pueblo boliviano con su voto.
What the Bolivian people have expressed today is the consolidation of change.
Estamos acá para seguir avanzando.
We're here to move forward with the recovery of our natural resources, the consolidation of nationalization.
In Olympic news, police in Hong Kong threw two pro-Tibet protesters out of the city's Olympics equestrian arena early on Saturday. The pair had smuggled a Tibetan flag into the venue, but were forcefully dragged away as they tried to reach into their bag for the flag. One of the protesters, Christina Chan, described what happened.
Yeah, I was dragged out by the police. So you can see, like, I've been bleeding from, like, being dragged on the floor. And then this is from the security guards. This is from the security guards inside when they had this, like, cardboard that was, like, slicing my arm open. In the beginning, we hoped to actually go in and we hoped to hold up a Tibetan flag and also this outer banner, you know, in protest of the Communist Party's one-party rule in China.
Meanwhile, investigative journalist Ken Silverstein has revealed NBC News China analyst for the Olympic Games is a close business associate, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. NBC's analyst Joshua Cooper Ramos is the managing director and partner at the Beijing office of Kissinger Associates. In Burma, 48 pro-democracy activists were arrested Friday as they held a protest to mark the 20th anniversary of the August 8, 1988 uprising. In India, victims of the Bhopal gas leak have ended months of sit-in protests after the government promised more help for survivors. Thousands of people died in 1984 when a pesticide plant owned by the U.S. firm Union Carbide spewed deadly cyanide gas into the air. The Indian government has also promised to take legal action against Dow Chemical, which bought Union Carbide in 2001. A top Palestinian negotiator has said Palestinians may demand to become part of a binational state with Israel if Israel continues to reject the borders they propose for a separate country. The negotiator, Ahmed Khoury, said a two-state solution could be achieved only if Israel met their demands to withdraw from all occupied land. Israel has long objected to the idea of forging a joint state. Former presidential candidate John Edwards admitted Friday he had an extramarital affair in 2006 with an aide who produced videos for his campaign, but said Edwards was not the father of her infant daughter. Edwards says he is not. For months, Edwards had denied he had had an affair with the woman, Rielle Hunter. The affair was first reported by the National Enquirer. While the news about Edwards' affair has become front-page news, little attention has been paid to a recent report in the Los Angeles Times that exposed new details about how John McCain's first marriage ended after he started an affair with his current wife. The paper revealed McCain obtained an Arizona marriage license on March 6, 1980, to marry Cindy Hensley, even though at the time he was still legally married to his first wife, Carol. In labor news, Verizon and its two major unions have reached a tentative three-year contract, averting a possible strike. Under the deal, workers will receive raises totaling nearly 11%, and the company will continue to pay 100% of current workers' and retirees' health premiums. However, as part of the agreement, Verizon will no longer pay all the health insurance premiums for newly hired workers after they retire. In Japan, thousands of people gathered in Nagasaki to mark the 63rd anniversary of the atomic bombing of the city. The U.S. bombing killed more than 140,000 residents of the city. The Nagasaki mayor, Tomohisa Tao, called for the worldwide abolition of nuclear weapons.
We ask the United Nations and the international society to push North Korea, Pakistan, and Israel to denuclearize and hold strict measures against Iran's suspected nuclear weapons.
また、アメリカとの原子力協力が懸念されるインドにも、NPT
And here in the United States, a federal appeals court has ruled a private ski resort can go ahead and use recycled sewer water to make fake snow on a publicly owned mountain in Arizona considered sacred by 13 Native American tribes. A coalition of Native groups and environmentalists known as the Save the Peaks Coalition have been fighting for years to preserve the San Francisco Peaks located near Flagstaff. The coalition plans to appeal the ruling to the Supreme Court. Peace activist Cindy Sheehan's campaign for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's congressional seat is moving forward. On Friday, Sheehan qualified to get on the ballot as an independent candidate to challenge Pelosi. Sheehan has repeatedly criticized Nancy Pelosi for refusing to start impeachment proceedings against President Bush. And we end today's headlines with the news of three deaths. The Palestinian poet laureate Mahmoud Darwish has died at the age of 67. 3 days of mourning have been declared in the West Bank and Gaza. We'll have more on Mahmoud Darwish later in the broadcast. Anthony Russo, who helped Daniel Ellsberg leak the Pentagon Papers, has died at the age of 71. And the pioneering soul singer and songwriter Isaac Hayes is dead at the age of 65. Hayes was best known for his theme from Shaft. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to the escalating conflict between Russia and Georgia. Amidst reports of over 2,000 dead and 40,000 displaced, NATO Secretary General and President Bush have both condemned Russia's, quote, disproportionate use of force in Georgia. After 4 days of heavy fighting, Russian tanks are now approaching central Georgian cities away from the separatist regions of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Russian officials say Georgia provoked the assault by attacking South Ossetia late last week, causing heavy civilian casualties. Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili told journalists he signed a ceasefire proposal Monday, but news reports indicate the fighting continues. Georgia's a close U.S. ally, and despite Russian objections, the U.S. has backed Georgia's bid to enter NATO. On Friday at the Security Council, the United States and Britain appeared to back the Georgian invasion. Georgia also plays a pivotal role in the supply of oil from the Caspian region to the west, as the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceylon oil pipeline runs through much of the country. Retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner has been closely following the conflict. His reports are available on Danny Schechter's News Dissector blog. Colonel Sam Gardner joins us now on the phone. Welcome to Democracy Now! Colonel Gardner, are you with us? Colonel Gardner is speaking to us from his home in the Washington, D.C. area. We're just checking that phone line. Are you there? We'll go to a music break, and then we'll come back to what's happening in Georgia. Stay with us.
أعمل مع رفاق الكشف في محجر وأطفالي ثمانية أسل لهم رغيف الخبز والأكواب والدفتر من الصخر ولا أتوسل الصدقات من بابك ولا أصغر أمام بلاط أعتابك فهل تغضب سجل أنا عربي أنا اسم بلا لقب صبور في بلاد كل ما فيها يعيش بفورة الغضب جذوري قبل ميلاد الزمان رست وقبل تفتح الحقب أبي من أسرة المحراث لا من سادة النجب وجدي كان فلاحا بلا حسب ولا نسب يعلمني شموخ النفس قبل قراءة الكتب أنا عربي سجل أنا عربي ولون الشعر فحمي ولون العين بني ومن ذاتي على رأسي عقال فوق كوفية وكفي صلبة كالصخر تخمش من يلامسها وعنواني أنا من قرية عزلاء أمنسية شوارعها بلا أسماء وكل رجالها في الحقل والمحجر فهل تغضب سجل أنا عربي طلبت كروم أجدادي وأرضا كنت أفلحها أنا وجميع أولادي ولم تترك لنا سوى هذه الصخور فهل ستأخذها حكومتكم كما قيل إذن سجل برأس الصفحة الأولى أنا لا أكره الناس ولا أسطو على أحد ولكني إذا ما جعت أكل لحم مغتصبي حذاري حذاري من جوعي ومن غضبي أنا عربي
اسموري
سجل.
And you have been listening to the poetry of Mahmoud Darwish. 3 days of mourning have been declared in the West Bank and Gaza to mark the death of Mahmoud Darwish, the poet laureate of the Palestinians. Darwish was considered one of the most important Arab poets. He died on Saturday at the age of 67 years old at the Memorial Herman Hospital in Houston from complications following heart surgery. A small memorial service was held in Houston Sunday, and tens of thousands are expected to converge on the official state funeral in the West Bank city of Ramallah on Tuesday. A towering literary figure for over 4 decades, the poetry of Mahmoud Darwish is well known and loved across the Arab world by people from all walks of life. Darwish was born on March 13th, 1942 is the village of Birwe in Palestine. When he was 6 years old, the Israeli army occupied and then destroyed Birwe and over 400 other Palestinian villages. His family fled to Lebanon, then returned illegally to a nearby village of Dar al-Assad. Darwish and his family became internal refugees living under Israeli military rule, legally classified as present absent aliens. By the time Darwish left the country in 1970, he'd been imprisoned several times for reciting his poetry and traveling from village to village without a permit. He lived in exile until 1996, when he was allowed to return to visit his mother. Mahmoud Darwish was politically active for much of his life, has often been called a poet of resistance. He was a member of the Israeli Communist Party in the 60s, then joined the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or PLO. He was a member of the PLO's executive committee until he resigned in 1993 over the Oslo Peace Accords. Darwish has written over 30 volumes of poetry and prose and has been translated into 35 languages. He published his first book of poetry, Wingless Birds, at the age of 19. He won a number of awards during his life, including the Lenin Peace Prize in 1983 and the Lenin Foundation Prize for Cultural Freedom in 2001. I'm joined now by two poets who've translated some of Mahmoud Darwish's work, and we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Sinan Antun is with us in our Firehouse studio in New York, an Iraqi poet, novelist, translator, and filmmaker, and a professor at New York University, where he teaches Arabic literature. His last collection of poetry was published in English as Baghdad Blues. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Happy to be here.
Talk about the significance of Mahmoud Darwish.
It's really difficult to really encompass his significance on so many levels, as you mentioned, on the Palestinian level, but also as a cultural icon, but I would say also as probably one of the last great world poets, because while he started his early career as a poet of resistance, as he was known, but his genius was in transcending himself and to, first of all, bringing the Palestinian tragedy onto the world level, but also transcending himself and from a local great famous Arab poet to a world poet who was able really to also elevate, I would say, the general poetic taste in the Arab world, and to strike a balance between the personal and the political, and the balance between being a very important political poet, but also becoming something much more than that throughout his career, and especially developing so much in the last 10 or 15 years, at a time when most poets really struggle to write anything new.
How did you come to know him?
You know, Darwish's poetry is like bread. I mean, that's why so many of us were shocked, because we somehow took it for granted that he would always be there. But growing up in Iraq, we always read his poetry in school books, but also he would come to many of the cultural festivals in Iraq, and anyone who was interested in poetry, and, you know, poetry is the premier literary form and cultural form in the Arab world. So there is no escaping not being exposed to Mahmoud Darwish and coming to love his poetry, especially in the mid-80s, I would say, when he, in a way, inhabited a new level beyond just being the poet of resistance and the poet of Palestine. And I should say that many, of course, most of the obituaries, especially in English, are reducing him just to the poet of the Palestinian people. And he was that, but he was much more as well.
Did you meet him personally? When did you meet him personally?
I was fortunate enough to meet him personally twice, in Philadelphia when he came to receive the Lannan Prize, but also in Cairo in 2003, where he came from Ramallah to recite poetry in Cairo. I was fortunate enough to meet him with some of his translators there.
I wanted to go to Houston, actually, where Mahmoud Darwish died, to Fatih Jordan, the Houston-based Palestinian-American poet who was also a physician and a translator. You work at the hospital where Darwish died?
No, I trained at it, but no, I do not work at it, the hospital now.
Can you talk about Darwish's significance and how you came to know him?
I think Mahmoud Darwish is perhaps the most beautiful aspect of Palestine, Palestinians, and the Arab world and the Arab language in its contemporary moment. And having that much beauty, certainly, as Sinan mentioned, takes him beyond the local and the regional into a global and a universal status. He was a very shy man who people flocked to, and he also was a very gentle and generous man who knew a lot of people wanted so much from him: a cup of coffee, a conversation, a signature. He cherished his private life a lot, because he also knew that most of his other life was public. In his great poem Mural, he ends it with the line, "I am not mine, I am not mine, I am not mine." And even in his death, untimely and premature, he spoke true words. He had an amazing prescience, and it is part of his brilliance that all through the decades he could always write things that you could return to 10 or 20 years later and realize that he had an amazing sense of vision and timelessness.
Fatih Judah, you translated his last work, The Butterfly's Burden. Can you talk about that?
Mahmoud Darwish, as a poet who endlessly tried to renew himself. Again, Sinan said, you know, most accomplished poets, they stagnate in their twilight years, in their late styles, in Adorno's or Edward Said's phrase. But Darwish didn't believe in anything like that. He believed in a continual renewal of birth. And he always loved his newer works, and I wanted, when I got in touch with him, to not focus on what most of the Arab readers in the Arab world, and even in the outside the Arab world, always focus on his, you know, epic poems from the 80s and the 90s and even earlier than that. And he always wanted to take the reader with him to his newest work, to his newest elevation of language and aesthetic. And I focused on his latest work. Collected three books in one volume. The first book was called is called The Stranger's Bed, which is a collection of love poems, a dialogue between his eye and his feminine eye, and it incorporates a lot of the fundamentals and traditional canon, I guess, of love poetry. Developed into a contemporary and modern form and ideal. And also State of Siege, which was a memoir lyric poem for the destruction of Ramallah in the opening days of the Second Intifada. And then after that, a beautiful book, which I think was really a mark of a new breakthrough in his poetic sensibility, Don't Apologize for What You've Done. And in part, I wanted to do that because one of Darwish's brilliant features, I guess, is his ability to always change his language. And in The Stranger's Bed was in 1998, and Don't Apologize for What You've Done was in 2003. And if you read the first poem in the book and you read the last poem in the book, you know that there has been a change in the language, moving towards more conversational speech and perhaps daily speech, as he would tell me. Still a high lyric and complex metaphors, but it was something I admired about him a lot, and I think a lot of other people always admired his ability to always renew his work. And I wanted to put that in English. I don't think that unfortunately, it saddens me to say that he's a latecomer into English. He has been celebrated the world over. But I think I wish that he had been received and celebrated in English since, again, as Sinan mentioned, his rise to a class of world poet in the mid-80s and the early 90s. I don't know if that was a problem of not finding the right translators. It could be, but I'm not sure exactly that that would be the sole reason. I don't know exactly what the other reasons are.
Fadi Judah, could you read the last poem, his final poem, that you are translating now?
No, unfortunately, I cannot. It's a poem that would probably take 20 minutes to read. It's an epic poem called The Dice Player. Mahmoud Darwish called me about 3 months ago, told me about his deteriorating medical condition. And then I heard that he had read the poem in Ramallah, and when I read it, I knew exactly that he was, betting or, you know, throwing the dice on the possibility that this would be his last poem. And he requested from me that I translate it. I can tell you that it begins with, "Who am I to tell you, who am I to say to you what I say to you?" And Darwish's "Who am I" in previous poems has always been had the tone of a true question that really addresses the knowledge of the self. But in this poem, I think it took on a different tone of humility and resignation, because in its last stanza, he repeats it and he says, "Who am I to disappoint the void? Who am I? Who am I?"
Fatih Judah, you're in Houston. You're a doctor there. You're a poet. And the first memorial service, funeral, has been held for him there before Ramallah. Can you talk about what happened in Houston yesterday and also how Mahmoud Darwish died?
Well, he underwent a necessary major vascular surgery, and a surgery that carries a high amount of risk, sort of a catch-22. He was a brave man who loved life and loved to live it in full dignity, and he decided that he did not want to live with the shadow of death or of sudden death hanging over him, and he decided to go with the hope of coming out with a new life, or a lease on life, if you will, with this major surgery, knowing very well that if something did go wrong, he will not be the same Darwish. And I know in my heart that, and I know he told me this personally, that he wanted that if things did go wrong in the surgery, which of course, as I said, it was a very high risk surgery, that he would just wish not to, not to survive it. And somehow I believe that his body willed it. He's a very full of dignity, as I said, and he would not want to live half the man or three quarters of the man he used to be. There was a prayer for the dead, for his body yesterday in the Central Mosque in Houston. About 200 people showed up, and then later on in the evening there was a memorial service where several people spoke and honored him, and also a representative from the Palestinian Authority, Rafiq al-Husseini, came because several people from the Palestinian Authority were coming to accompany the body back to Amman, Jordan, I think where it would arrive today. It was a service where you can see the mixture of public relations to Darwish, where most people don't know how Darwish loved his coffee or loved his milk or how he slept or how he woke. Or he was a larger than life figure for us, and I think for many of us, because we did not get the chance to know him except through his poetry or through his public appearances, we forget that he was a man like us, and got up, shaved, took a shower, went to the bathroom, and all these simple daily things. And it was hard to try to focus on him as a person and not on him as a legendary figure who, as he says in one of his poems, both truly and sarcastically, I lived like no other poet has lived, a sage and a king. And it's an amazing feat, I think, to know that you have achieved immortality in your lifetime through your art. And as he says, death, all the arts have defeated you, death. He knows that his art has defeated death.
Many of Darwish's best love poems have become well-known songs throughout the Arab world because they were set to music by the Lebanese musician Marcel Khalife. I interviewed Khalife last year and asked him about Darwish's influence on his life and why he dedicated his latest album to Darwish. I want to turn to his response, but first an excerpt of Marcel Khalife singing or My Mother.
خبزي أمي وقهوتي أمي ولمسة أمي أحن إلى خبزي أمي وقهوتي.
At the beginning of the Lebanese civil war.
بال 76.
In 76.
كنت محجوز في قريتي.
I was confined to my village.
بسبب الأحداث السياسية.
Because of the political events.
وأنا لم أكن موافق على الموضوع السياسي التي تديره المنطقة منطقتنا يعني بالمنطقة الشرقية فكنت مضطر أن أكون داخل منزلي يعني.
I was not in agreement with the political trend in our area, the eastern area, so I had to stay indoors in my house.
ولم يكن معي في تلك الخلوة إلا العود ودواوين محمود درويش.
In that retreat, I only had the oud and the books of Mahmoud Darwish.
وكنت بعدني متخرج من الكونسرفاتوار من المعهد الموسيقي.
I had just graduated from the conservatory.
كنت بتعرف شاب طموح بدي يغير العالم.
I was an ambitious young man who wanted to change the world.
بالأخير واحد ما فيه غير حتى حاله.
But in the final analysis, one cannot even change oneself.
المهم قلت لازم أعمل شيء.
I said to myself, I have to do something.
بدأت بتلحين هذه القصائد لمحمود درويش.
I began putting these Mahmoud Darwish poems to music.
لحنتهم لإلي لأنا أكون موجود حاضر يعني.
I put them to music so that I could feel my own presence.
وما كنت يعني بعرف إنه هؤلاء رح يتحولوا لأهذه الشعبية ويترددوا من ملايين الناس.
I never thought that they would become popular songs and sung by millions of people.
وحسست بأنه نص محمود درويش ربما كتب لي.
I felt that Mahmoud Darwish possibly wrote his words for me.
أو أنزل علي.
Or it was revealed to me.
فعلاقة 30 سنة مع شاعر محمود درويش.
A relationship that dates back 30 years with the poetry of Mahmoud Darwish.
حبيت بهذا العمل. الموسيقى إنه هدية.
In this work, I wanted to dedicate to him.
لا صوتي موجود بهذا العمل.
My voice is not part of this work.
ولا شعره موجود.
And neither is his poetry.
ولكن دائما بحس إنه خبز أمه بيشبه خبز أمي.
But I have always felt that his mother's bread is like my mother's bread.
وعيون ريتا الجميلة تشبه عيون ريتا أنا.
The eyes of his beautiful Rita look like the eyes of my beautiful Rita.
هنود الحمر بيشبه هنود الحمر أيضا.
His red Indians also look like mine.
رمله وعصافيره كلهم بيشبهوا نفس رملي وعصافيره.
His sand and his birds also look like my sand and my birds.
لهذا السبب أهديت هذا.
That's why I dedicated this work to him.
That was Marcel Khalife talking about the significance of Mahmoud Darwish's work. Sinan Antun, can you talk about the growth of Darwish's work and its effect inside and outside the Arab world? He was also extremely accomplished in Hebrew.
Yes, well, as I said before, I mean, he started out within what we call the poetry of resistance inside when, of course, Palestinians, their movement was confined and their identity was being erased. If we all remember how Golda Meir said notoriously, there are no Palestinians. So Mahmoud Darwish's response was, I am an Arab, or register, I am an Arab and I exist. And he also, his own life in a way encapsulates the Palestinian tragedy in terms of confinement, in terms of having his village destroyed and then of being continuously displaced. But by the time he left to the Soviet Union and then to Cairo, he had already been very famous. But then he also accompanied the Palestinian saga through Beirut and then the exodus from Beirut. And there are many of the poets of resistance who were famous at the time but kept on writing in the same vein. But Mahmoud is the one who really changed and evolved. And an important factor here is that he was a voracious reader and he was really open to all of the world traditions. I mean, he himself says always that every poet contains thousands of poets within him. So he contains multitudes because he really mastered the Arabic tradition, but he was a voracious reader, open to all world traditions. And you can see through his poetry that he tried to weave in the Palestinian saga into other tragedies of native peoples, including the Native Americans here. Perhaps one could say that if even Ariel Sharon had to admit that he loved and admired Mahmoud Darwish's poetry, that really says something. Because if poetry can pierce Sharon's heart, then that is really some powerful poetry. But I want to add that he is also a really great prose writer and one of the greatest prose writers we have in his famous Memory of Forgetfulness, the journal about the Beirut siege. But also recently he wrote an unbelievable prose work called In the Presence of Absence and kind of anchored. So while a great poet, at the same time, he is really a great essayist.
Mahmoud Darwish appeared in the 2004 film by the acclaimed French director Jean-Luc Godard called Notre Musique. This is an excerpt of Darwish's conversation with an Israeli journalist.
Truth has two faces. We've listened to the Greek mythology. And at times we've heard the Trojan victim speak through the mouth of the Greek Euripides. As for me, I'm looking for the poet of Troy, because Troy didn't tell its story. And I wonder, does a land that has great poets have the right to control a people that has no poets? And is the lack of poetry amongst the people enough reason to justify its defeat? Is poetry a sign, or is it an instrument of power? Can a people be strong without having its own poetry? I was a child of people that had not been recognized until then. And I wanted to speak in the name of the absentee, in the name of the Trojan poet. There's more inspiration and humanity in defeat than there is in victory. If I belong to the victor's camp, I demonstrate my support for the victims. Do you know why we Palestinians are famous? Because you are our enemy. The interest in us stems from the interest in the Jewish issue. The interest is in you, not in me. So we have the misfortune of having Israel as an enemy, because it enjoys unlimited support. And we have the good fortune of having Israel as our enemy, because the Jews are the center of attention. You've brought us defeat and renown.
That was an excerpt of Mahmoud Darwish in the film of Jean-Luc Godard. We now turn to the words and voice of Mahmoud Darwish, his film, his poetry, his poem, I Am.
The echo gets closer, breaking the distance. Thundering finds the echo and resounds forever here, here forever. And the time has gone. The echo has become a country here. Oh, Father, crack the walls of the universe. Echo surrounding the echo. And let it explode. And I am from here, and here I am. And I am I, and here I am. And I am I.
Mahmoud Darwish. In 2000, the Israeli Ministry of Education proposed introducing his works into the school curriculum, but met strong opposition from right-wing protesters. The then Prime Minister Ehud Barak said the country was not ready. Mahmoud Darwish died this weekend in Houston, Texas, his body being flown to Ramallah, where there will be a major funeral, thousands expected on Tuesday. We will continue to cover Mahmoud Darwish, his poetry, his legacy. and what happens in these next few days. Fadi Judah, thank you for joining us. Houston-based Palestinian-American poet and physician, and Sinan Antoun, joining us here in New York, Iraqi poet and professor at New York University. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll go to the conflict between Russia and Georgia. Stay with us. كان عيدا في فمي جسم ردة كان عرسا في دمي وأنا ضعت بردة سنتين وهي نامت فوق زندي سنتين وأنا ضعت بردة سنتين وهي نامت فوق زندي سنتين وتعاهدنا على أجمل كأس واحترقنا 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 في نبيد الشفاف وولدنا في نبيد الشفاف وولدنا مرتين اسمه ريتا. Marcel Khalife singing Rita with the words of Mahmoud Darwish. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn back now to the escalating conflict between Russia and Georgia amidst reports of over 2,000 dead, 40,000 displaced, NATO Secretary General President Bush both condemning Russia's, quote, disproportionate use of force in Georgia. After 4 days of heavy fighting, Russian tanks are now approaching central Georgian cities away from the separatist regions of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Russian officials say Georgia provoked the assault by attacking South Ossetia late last week, causing heavy civilian casualties. The Georgian president, Mikhail Saakashvili, told journalists he signed a ceasefire proposal Monday, but news reports indicate the fighting continues. Georgia is a close U.S. ally. Despite Russian objections, the U.S. has backed Georgia's bid to enter NATO. On Friday, at the Security Council, the United States and Britain appeared to back the Georgian invasion. Georgia also plays a pivotal role in the supply of oil from the Caspian region to the west, as the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceylon oil pipeline runs through much of the country. We're now joined on the telephone by retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner, who's been closely following the conflict. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Talk about this area that probably most people in this country have never heard of before.
Yes, it's very interesting that it is probably what some analysts have called an area of frozen conflicts. After the Soviet Union dissolved, there remained areas in which, despite the fact that new states were created, there were tensions. One of those is the Ossetia, or South Ossetia, which is where we've seen the fighting, and the other one inside Georgia is Abkhazia. There were agreements signed in the early 1990s that sort of solidified these as semi-independent territories. In one, there is a UN peacekeeping force, and then in South Ossetia, there was essentially independence. And, you know, they sort of ran their operations separate from the Georgian government. And then tensions began to increase over the past few months because the president of Georgia has promised to retake, his words, retake the particularly South Ossetia. That was a problem because by now 90% of the Ossetians there were holders of Russian passports. They had voted to become part of the Russian Federation. There was clear movement in the direction of this enclave, closer and closer ties with Russia. And then last week, almost without announcement, the Georgians launched a strike into Ossetia, with the apparent objective of putting this back under Tbilisi control, back under the control of the Georgian government. The Russians responded probably in a way that was a great deal surprise to the Georgians. It probably was also a surprise to the United States. And as of this morning, the Georgians seem to have pulled out of South Ossetia, and the Russians have control of the capital city and are beginning to put in humanitarian aid. The one issue left up in the air has to do with the other enclave, Abkhazia. There was a small portion of that enclave that was controlled by the Georgians. It was called the Kodori Gorge. Operations were launched there yesterday, some on Saturday night, in an attempt to dislodge the Georgians and turn that territory over and completely make it independent from Georgian control. So this morning, the fighting seems to be waning, although there are reports of still airstrikes going on. It appears as if we have gotten through the heavy part of the fighting, but certainly not the important strategic consequences.
Can you talk about the significance of this in terms of nuclear warfare and Russia? Do we have anything to fear along those lines?
Absolutely. Let me just say that if you were to rate how serious the strategic situations have been in the past few years, this would be above Iraq, this would be above Afghanistan, and this would be above Iran. Little notice to Americans, the Russians learned at the end of the first Gulf War that they didn't think they could deal with the United States given the value and the quality of American precision conventional weapons. The Russians put into their doctrine a statement and have broadcast it very loudly that if the United States were to use precision conventional weapons against Russian troops, the Russians would be forced to respond with tactical nuclear weapons. They continue to state this. They practice this in their exercise. They've even had exercises that very closely paralleled what went on in Ossetia, where there was an independence movement. They intervene conventionally to put down the independence movement. The United States and NATO responds with conventional airstrikes. They then respond with tactical nuclear weapons. It appears to me as if the Russians were preparing themselves to do that in this case. First of all, I think they believed the United States was going to intervene. At a news conference on Sunday, a deputy national security advisor said, "We have noted that the Russians have introduced two SS-21 medium-range ballistic missile launchers into South Ossetia." And let me say a little footnote about those. They're both conventional and nuclear. They have a relatively small conventional warhead, however. So the military significance, if they were to be conventional, was almost trivial compared to what the Russians could deliver with the aircraft that they were using to strike the Georgians. I think this was a signal. I think this was an implementation on their part of their doctrine. It clearly appears as if they expected the United States to do what they had practiced in their exercises. In fact, this morning, the Russians had an air defense exercise in the southern part of Russia that borders Georgia, in which it was practicing shooting down incursion aircraft that were incursion into Russia. They were prepared for the United States to intervene, and I think they were prepared, or at least they were wanting to show the United States that their doctrine of the use of tactical nuclear weapons if the U.S. attacks was serious. And they needed to take, the United States needs to take Russia very seriously.
We're talking to Colonel Sam Gardner about this war that is taking place. Would you call it a war, Colonel Gardner?
Well, you know, I love that term, that, and I wish I'd invented it. It's called frozen conflicts. It is a resolution of a conflict that's been around for 17 years. It was pushed off-center by the Georgians. Even the Georgians were reluctant to declare war. They declared a state of emergency. Certainly the Russians haven't declared war. In fact, I guess I would say, Amy, you know, with our war on terrorism, I don't even know if there's a definition of war anymore. Probably is best to call it a very serious conflict that could have been escalated.
And the significance of the pipeline that is there?
Well, the United States, beginning about 10 years ago, obviously saw the vulnerability of the flow of oil out of the Persian Gulf. So the United States pushed very hard to set up a pipeline that went from Baku in Azerbaijan, taking out the Caspian Sea oil, to a port in Turkey, Ceyhan. That oil pipeline carries about 1% of the world's oil supply. 2 weeks ago, that pipeline was blown up in the Turkish area by the Kurdish rebels that the Turks are fighting. There were reports that the Russians had bombed this over the weekend. Reports this morning, however, suggest that there hasn't been an interruption, except that Azerbaijan has shut off flow in the pipeline. So this interferes with a major flow of oil to the economies of the West. It's an important source of the oil flow.
Colonel Gardner, I also wanted to ask you about the presidential candidates' responses to the conflict. Senator Barack Obama and John McCain, the report coming out about John McCain's advisor, Schuneman, who helped a U.S. firm win a Georgian energy firm deal while lobbying for Georgia's NATO membership.
I must say that I have not heard a lot of good words from the McCain campaign about how to deal with this. It's painful that the standard answer one gets is the testosterone-based foreign policy that we've seen for the last 8 years. This is a very complex situation. And John McCain has said earlier that he wants to throw Russia out of the G8. That is absolutely the worst thing the United States could do. Russians have been saying, and the White House has not been listening, we are a major player, and you have to listen to us. This is the way the president said the Chinese are major players, and we now listen to them. The Russians have been saying that. The White House has ignored that. I also would say, on the other hand, that this is one of those situations where Obama's talk about it is probably not a good solution either. The United States made some errors when it left the impression with the Georgians that our support somehow meant they were free to undertake this operation. That was clearly a bad idea that we communicated with them. The other thing that is significant here is there is an Israeli dimension to the problem. Israel has been training and supplying the Army of Georgia. It's caused some tensions within Israel because there are those who believe that this just encourages the Russians to provide conventional arms to the Iranians. Israel has talked about it over the weekend, decided not to stop providing arms to the Georgians. It isn't over. There are a lot of strategic things that are going to fall out of this. Probably the most important is that it's not now Iraq, Afghanistan, and Iran. It's now Russia, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Iran that a new president's going to have to deal with.
Colonel Sam Gardner, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll certainly continue to follow this conflict. Colonel Gardner, retired Air Force colonel, has taught strategy and military operations at the National War College, as well as the Air War College and the Naval War College. This is Democracy Now! If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website. Tomorrow, we will take on the issue of the federal judge ruling that the U.S. government owes a group of Native Americans close to $500 million, so they'd ask asked for $47 billion. We'll talk to the lead plaintiff, Eloise Cobell. We will also look at what happened in the vote in Bolivia. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduce, Aaron Mata, Angelique Comet, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Masood, Robbie Karen. Happy birthday to Jeffrey Hagerman. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.